This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, healthcare is the major topic in the legislature these days. We'll listen in on a portion of a recent testimony from the Healthcare Committee. We'll hear about a pictorial genealogy of the Anakin-ish movement. We'll talk with the drummer of the Crash Test Dummies and a program that wants to pay cab fares for people who can't afford them. All of that coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. Recently, the Legislature Standing Committee on Health heard from a record 12 witnesses regarding plans for healthcare redevelopment in Cape Breton. Among the witnesses, Brett McDougall, Executive Director for the Eastern Zone of the Nova Scotia Health Authority, Dr. Kevin Orrell, the Senior Medical Director for the Cape Breton Redevelopment, and Mickey Doyle, Clinical Director for New Waterford and North Sydney Redevelopment. They were responding to questions asked by PCMLA for Northside Westmount, Eddie Orrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for appearing for me today. Continuing on what Minister McCollum just asked about the closures of the Northside General and the Waterford while the build is taking place. My opinion is they're being kept open because they're needed. There is not enough capacity at the regional hospital now to handle the mass volumes, one of emergency care, two of acute care, and three of long-term care until this build is completed. The build is great, and I think it's the best thing that happened to our cancer unit because we see a lot more people. But the emergency room expansion is going to be 12 beds. The Northside General has over 10,000 visits a year in its diminished capacity now because there are no physicians. So is keeping these facilities open mean acute care, long-term care, and emergency care? Because right now, emergency care is not happening at our facilities. It's not happening in New Waterford. And in the month of January, February, Glace Bay has a bulk of the times their emergency room was closed. And the regional just can't handle it. It was never designed to handle five hospitals. It was designed to handle two actual acute care facilities and a mental health facility at that time. So does keeping them open mean all aspects of it, and what are we going to do to keep those emergency rooms operating to take the strain off of the emergency room at the regional hospital until that happens?
Mr. McDougall.
Thanks, Eddie, for your question. Very, very concerning for Cape Breton. We hear comments from patients and families frequently about this issue. In relation to keeping those departments open, the emergency department physician resource challenges that we face within Eastern Zone, Cape Breton, provincially, nationally, very difficult to correct that within a short time frame. So we are working with our colleagues, our physician colleagues in the emergency program of care, in collaboration with senior executive leadership to see what possible options are available to us to look at what could be possible in relation to North Sydney and Glace Bay in particular. The Waterford, the physicians in that facility, in that community resource, the emergency center at that site, fairly well. There are certainly some gaps from time to time, month to month. We have looked at additional payment schemes in relation to challenging shifts, in relation to different shifts that are difficult to cover. So the ED program of care, Dr. Milburn, is working with Dr. RJ McKenzie to see what could be possible in relation to shift incentives for evenings, nights, and weekends to help ensure that the resources at the Cape Breton Regional Facility are able to take care of emergencies. To your point about North Sydney and the 10,000 visits they see, similarly in Glace Bay, with the visits that they see there, we know historically that 60 to 70% of the visits are not emergency in nature. That doesn't mean that they're not those patients do not require care. So it's more of a, how do we ensure they have primary care access? So we're looking at a number of different options in relation to what could be possible in the short term for North Sydney and Glace Bay. We have also put out LOCA masks, and there, you know, there's some challenges with that in relation to gaining licensure through the college. And so we work with the college to try and see if there's the ability to influence a change in relation to how we intake locums to the area. And we've recently just had some locums that worked in North Sydney to provide some coverage. But in, you know, in the short term, it is very challenging, and I'm not going to pretend we have a, you know, a silver bullet to correct that. We have put some additional measures in place at the regional facility. We're looking at non-traditional spaces to try and create some capacity. So there's some additional beds on some of the units that we moved into over the last number of months to help with that flow. And as Minister Martin had pointed out, you know, the last 4 months have been very challenging, and healthcare is difficult and challenging. It's hard to predict when people require emergency care or urgent care. And, you know, as she had mentioned, the last couple of months have been difficult, and we've been in some overcapacity situations. But with that being said, the last week has been, we've been doing quite well, limited amount of admissions in the Cape Breton Regional Emergency Department, which allowed for patient flow to go through the facility and allow for the appropriate care in the appropriate places. So don't have a, you know, a quick answer or a quick solution to the current issues, but we are, you know, working with our partners, our physician colleagues, and leaders within the organizations to try and come up with some solutions in the short term while we work on the Cape Breton redevelopment project.
Mr. Oral.
Thank you, Mr. McDougall. So the real concern is you're saying that 60% of the visits to these emergency rooms aren't necessarily emergency room visits. I've been given those stats before. I was told that the acuity of the Northside General, when they were talking about reducing the pay that the doctors get at the, when they work in these facilities compared to what they got at the regional, that because they weren't as necessary emergency visits, but the percentage of emergency visits is the same in the outlying hospitals as it is at the regional hospital. So that was out the window, that acuity was different. I've had doctors in my office that have volunteered to work these facilities when they were being closed, and they were told by the people in charge that they weren't going there because the facility was being closed. So we had the opportunity to keep them open, and we as a group, and I take it as a government, as a healthcare authority, as politicians, we're blocking that. And the build the hospital and they will come regime, I hope it works. I've seen the movie Field of Dreams where they build a ball field and the players came to play. But we've got to do something more. But we've got 5 years before that happens. And we've got nothing right now as a plan to bring these doctors to keep these departments open. They're having difficulty with the Northside, or with the regional hospital, keeping physicians there at any given time in the emergency room because they're just not there. The fear is, with the closures, doctors and healthcare professionals aren't going to apply to these facilities right now. And they're having difficulty staffing them. What are we going to do in the meantime to prevent this from happening, to keep people here and to bring them here while we're in the build phase?
Mr. McDougall.
Your question in relation to, or your point in relation to physicians that have asked or come forward and said they're willing to work in those facilities in the emergency departments as they currently exist, I'm unaware of those individuals that have come forward and put that place or that request forward. So if, you know, following this meeting, if you want to identify who those individuals were, we can certainly follow up with them to see if there's the opportunity for them to help support and resource those facilities to support the communities. I know we have the nursing staff available, and we've just currently transferred them over to the regional development or the regional center to help with the increased demand on that site. But certainly, if we have physicians that are, you know, willing to and able to work in those facilities, we can place those nursing staff back in those facilities to ensure that there's care in those communities.
Thank you. That's good to know. That's well appreciated. I guess my question to you, Dr. Oral, is you've been put, you took this job to be a voice, which I understand. You were very vocal about it first, and I know that, and I talked to you since then, and it's because of the voice. If your voice has something to offer that's different than what the go-ahead plan is, will that be accepted by the committee, by the group, by the government? As I know, let's say something like the Northside General is not going to have an emergency room, but they're going to have a collaborative practice type hospital. Will there be an acute care minor injury clinic in this facility, so that if someone cuts their eye or a child has an earache, instead of waiting at the regional for a length of time for real what they call non-emergency care, will there be an acute care facility there with maybe two or three beds that the doctors that work in that facility will be able to staff that on an hourly basis, so that not all one person is taking up their time with that, so it'll be an hour a day or an hour every second day or whatever it might be? And are there going to be any possibility of an acute care bed for someone who just might need observation, say for an overnight or for that would take that strain off of, because the acute care beds that are on the north side now and the acute care beds that are in New Waterford, there's not enough facilities at the regional hospital to handle those numbers. And so is there something that might be, with public input or yourself input, if there's something different, will that be accepted, and will the committee look at that as something that the community has come forward and it's something to look at?
Dr. Oral, and then I believe Mr. Day.
So that's very important. When we talk about a healthcare center, we have to recognize truly what it is. There's an impression that we are just adding on a little clinic like a dental clinic at the Mayflower Mall. These are standalone, world-class facilities that are large, that will contain many, many clinics. And yes, to reduce the strain on an emergency department in terms of numbers of people, there will be facilities in these healthcare centers that will address the earaches, the wound changes, the IV drugs that have to be administered to patients who are living in their own home. All of those things where people are going to receive the care in the community in which they live. That's a very, very strong benefit of what's being redeveloped. And this will make it much easier for the seniors in these communities, because they are populations of seniors that live there, to access care exactly where they live. And it will have the benefit of reducing the need for ambulance drives to a big hospital. It will reduce the amount of patients that are waiting to be seen and waiting for examination rooms. Our medical residents, the family medicine residents, over half of the medical residents that we train want to do a plus 1 year in emergency medicine. It's a young man's game. People resign because they get tired or they get burnt out. So these people are going to train to be emergency room physicians. They welcome the chance to come back to a facility that will allow them to do what they see on television as emergency room physicians. They want to look after the people that are in distress, the people that have heart attacks. They're not interested in seeing someone whose child has a runny nose. They want to do the television emergency medicine stuff. This is kind of the setup that's going to take place at a redeveloped emergency at the Cape Breton Regional Hospital. So the recruitment of that kind of trainee back to Cape Breton is very, very real.
Mr. Day, 1 minute.
Thanks for the question, Eddie. You and I have chatted in the past about this sort of stuff. We talk about the collaborative practices, and I've talked with the physicians in North Sydney, and we talk about the access to these next day, same day kind of appointments that that people don't necessarily need to go to an ER for, and how do we do that? So we work with the physicians, so Stephanie Langley, Joan Sala, the physicians on the north side, and we're working with them to try and figure out what works best to try and to see that population of patient. And it may not be the exact same in North Sydney as it is in New Waterford. So we're working with the physicians in New Waterford, Jen Lang, Peter Littlejohn, Steve Farrell. Those physicians are there to say, we have this population that you're currently seeing in your CEC. Don't necessarily need an ER visit. What's the best approach to do that? So trying to work with them, maybe it's after-hours access in their collaborative practice. Maybe it's some sort of a walking clinic. We don't know yet, but we are having those conversations with them because we have identified that those are patients that still need to be seen moving forward, but just not necessarily to be seen in an ER. So how do we do that best?
Antigonish-based publishing company Harp Publishing recently came to Cape Breton to unveil their inaugural offering, The People's Photo Album, a pictorial genealogy of the Antigonish movement. The book was released to mark the 90th anniversary of the St. Evex Extension Department. Dialogue spoke with Harp co-founder Dorothy Lander about the new book, The Antigonish Movement, and the movement's Cape Breton roots.
My husband and I have both we're both researchers, Art for Health researchers. My husband, John Graham Pohl, began a program at the Center for Arts and Medicine at the University of Florida back in the early 90s, and that's a flagship program for arts and medicine really in North America. And then I met him, and he decided that we had to decide whether we were going to live in Florida or Nova Scotia, and Nova Scotia won hands down. And I was at the time, we both retired at the same time. I retired from a faculty position in adult education at St. Evex, and I retired with a research grant, federal research grant, to look at art and the women's movement across three generations, and that turned out to have quite a lot to do with art and health as well. So we were publishing all of this stuff in academic journals, which very few people get to read, and we prefer a rather narrative way of writing, autobiographical way of writing. Often what we wrote wasn't appropriate for academic journals, so we thought, oh well, we'll put some of our, we'll start our own publishing company and get it out there to the world, then maybe more people will read it. So our first publication, we got registered in June of 2018, and our first publication was released in December of last year, 2018, the People's Photo Album, Pictorial Genealogy of the Antigonish Movement.
Like you said, this is the inaugural publication for Hart Publishing. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of putting it together? Because I imagine it seems to me that it was quite collaborative in putting this together.
It was a mini cooperative movement in its own right. we have the album itself has something like 800 photos and something like 150 contributors, and we just went out and asked people if we to look in their family albums and their scrapbooks and their smartphones and to find photos, and not to get too hung up on the idea that it had to do something with the Antigonish movement. I just wanted everybody to find photos of people interacting. And my thought was that, you know, we learn about cooperation, we make art, we play, we're kind to each other from the very earliest moments. And so the photo album, as it turns out, we follow people through generations, as many as five generations of the Antigonish movement. I did go to families that had some kind of connection with the Antigonish movement, like Clyde Nunn, the first station master of CJFX. The extension department at St. Evex did a lot of programming back there in the 1950s. So we have the Nunn family through generations in the photo album, and many more. We have Maureen Cody is now from the Marguerite. She's the grandniece of Dr. Moses Cody, and so I've got those generations right through to her son Tyler McLean, who recently graduated from law school and is really working with Indigenous people in the North. I didn't know if this would happen. This was my hunch starting out, that we'd find that social justice theme, that cooperative theme, that adult education theme would thread through generations, and it does. It absolutely does.
Now, could you tell our listeners a little bit more about the Antigonish movement? Because it might be, now I know, particularly around here in Glace Bay, where we're literally just up the road from Tompkinsville, If you could maybe explain the roots of the Antigonish movement.
It's really hard, you know, social movements. You can't really say when a social movement starts, but there's certainly it took off in Cape Breton. We took the people's photo album to Parkland on Thursday night, and I really felt like I was in the heartland of the Antigonish movement because it was. You know, it began Father Jimmy Tompkins, Father Moses Cody really recognized the conditions in which the miners, the fishermen, the teachers, the steel workers in especially in Cape Breton, some of the conditions that they were living in. And I think what makes the, you know, the 20s, 30s, the People's Library with Father Tompkins and Sister Frances Dolores in the 1940s in reserve mines, that's part of the movement. Tompkinsville in the 30s is part of the Antigonish movement to address the whole exploitation of miners and the living conditions that they were in. There's so many. I mean, the Tompkinsville was the first cooperative housing initiative in North America, and people came from all over North America to see it.
Now, and I also want to ask you, because Father Moses Cody, of course, he was the first director of the St. Avex Extension Department.
That's right.
Now, I do want to ask you, maybe to explain to the listeners, what the Extension Department is.
Well, the Extension Department was founded in 1928, 90 years ago. In fact, I made the People's Photo Album a tribute to the Extension Department. And I think it was a way of the Extension Department. One of the things I say in the album is that extension is not a very useful word because it confuses people. there was some talk that really it was a social action department out of St. Avex. So it was outreach into the community to address situations of leadership in communities, social and economic development, and adult education. And the Extension Department in the early days and sort of reached out to northeastern Nova Scotia. And by 1959, this is also an anniversary year, Father Moses Cody wanted it to become the whole Extension Department to become international. And in 1959, after Father Cody had died, the first students of the Cody International Institute were enrolled.
You'd mentioned the Parkland event that occurred last Thursday. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that event, because I understand there were some people there that were related to the Antigonish movement it was a very engaged audience, from what I understand.
That is for sure. Now, the reason we went to Parkland, Cape Breton, is because Sister Margaret McDonnell, just my best storyteller ever, she resides there, and she provided me with a photo of herself and her brother, Father Malcolm McDonnell, with Alex and Ella Laidlaw. Alex Laidlaw was a teacher at Port Hood Academy. He was a teacher for his wife Ella McMillan, and for first Malcolm, and then Sister Margaret. So the photo she gave me was of her and Father Malcolm with the Laidlaws. So this was last year she gave me, so gave it to me. So, you know, she's not very mobile. So we took, she was really wanted to see the album, so we took it to her. And then we thought, well, there'll be other people who'd be really interested in this album too. So we made a presentation and we filled the room. And it was an amazing event in the sense that, you know, there was that demographic. There were the older people and they had their stories to tell. Father Fred, Morley was there and he was telling how he was in the same dormitory as Alan J. McKechnie and they graduated the same year from St. Evex in 1944 and he would see Alan J. every year. And, you know, he talked about other sort of events in the Antigonish movement and how Father Jimmy Tompkins started the People's Library in reserve mines, and then there were, you know, just stories came out, and there was a woman who, because I had kind of called the whole event the unsung heroes of the Antigonish movement. Like it occurred to me that maybe there would be quite a lot of people that wouldn't have known too much about that Alan J. McKechnie, before he became a politician, was economics professor at St. Evex and did a lot of the extension department programming through CJFX. But in fact, probably a lot of the folks in the room did know that, the older folks, but the younger folks wouldn't have known that story. Oh yes, and there was a woman in the audience because of the unsung heroes theme. She said, "Oh well, you must." She said, "That's pushing me to raise the name of Father John Capstick," and. I didn't get her name. I'm sorry, I didn't. But I understand there's a Father John Capstick Center in Sydney, and because Father John Capstick was he was in the Sydney Extension Office.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I invited one of the things that. I invited people who were with the Extension Department, including Dr. Teresa McNeil. Dr. Teresa McNeil was Director of Extension from, I think, 1982 till 1993. And she couldn't come because she's still doing the work of the Antigonish movement, but outside the boundaries of St. Evex. She couldn't come because she was drumming up awareness and money for a climate change adaptation forum in Halifax that's coming in June. So she is still doing the social justice work of the Antigonish movement.
So the movement continues. It started from very humble seeds back in the late 20s and has grown into a thriving movement that continues its work to this day.
Yes, and I don't know if it's always, I don't think it's always named that this is an influence of the Antigonish movement, but that's if we use the language of social media, I think we can almost say that it's gone viral, and so it's way beyond the borders of St. Evex and the Extension Department. My hunch is that we wouldn't have such a cooperative organization as Syria Antigonish Families Embrace if it weren't for that whole incubator of the Antigonish movement. You may have heard of Peace by Chocolate.
Oh yes.
And there is an amazing committee in Antigonish that has brought in I think it's something like 10 Syrian families have just come to a little place like Antigonish, and I know there are many other places as well. And it's a cooperative movement. It's an adult education movement, and it's social justice.
And now back to the People's Photo Album. Yeah. So I know you hand delivered 5 copies of it to various institutions around Cape Breton Island.
I did. And one thing about hand delivering it, well, there's 2 copies going to the Cape Breton Regional Library. One's going to go to the Tompkins Memorial Library in Reserve Mines, and the other to the main library. And 2 to Cape Breton University, 1 to the main library, 1 to Beaton Institute, and Parkland wanted one for their residents. So, and one thing about hand delivering, it's a very expensive book because of all of the 800 photos. But one thing that I like to point out, first of all, it's expensive because of the photos, but it's also expensive because it's an art book, and there are artists. The artists, in a way, are the miners and the fishermen and the teachers of days gone by. It's artists that often struggle with making a living. So we paid artists, and we paid them what they deserve to put together this album, which includes the whole desktop publishing and the layout. Kathy Lynn was our graphic artist. We had Adam Tregakis make the artwork for the back cover, which is a whimsical kitchen meeting, which has the kind of the old members of the Antigonish movement, it has Joe Laban and Mary Arnold and Tompkinsville, but it has Father Tompkins, it has Father Cody. It has the Sisters of St. Martha in it, and they're all circled around Zita O'Hearn Cameron and her typewriter. And the typewriter is an unsung hero because that's the typewriter out of which came Father Moses Cody's Masters of Their Own Destiny. And so the kitchen, this creative piece of artwork is listing all of the social justice organizations that they can think of that are carrying on the legacy of the Antigonish movement.
And where else will the book be available for anybody who wants to purchase it?
We have a website, and it's www.harppublishing.ca, so you can purchase it online. And I should say, because it is so expensive, it is $250, but any time that we can hand deliver it, as we did to Cape Breton, we will donate the cost of shipping and packaging to a social justice organization. When we launched the book in Antigonish in December, there were 14 copies donated around this community, and we donated we could write a nice little check to Antigonish Affordable Housing, and that seemed like a nice kind of symmetry because the chair of Antigonish Affordable Housing is Colleen Cameron. And Colleen Cameron is the daughter of Zita O'Hearn Cameron and Ray Cameron. Both her parents met at the Extension Department. They both worked at the Extension Department, and Dr. Cody officiated at their wedding. So that seemed like the right organization to make the first donation to.
Mitch Dorge has been playing drums since he was 6 years old, but drums don't have that much to do with why the drummer for the Crash Test Dummies is on a 2-week-long tour of Cape Breton schools. Dialogue spoke with Dorge about his quest to empower youth.
And what is the drummer for the Crash Test Dummies doing in Cape Breton? And first of all, is he enjoying his visit?
Am I enjoying it? That's putting it mildly. Being out here so far has been nothing but a joy. Spent the day in Bedeck yesterday. What more can you ask? The love of my life is actually from Lewisburg. And so we get out here every now and then.
Well, you just made the connection of a lifetime then. Listen, every listener right now loves you already.
Well, I have a lot of ties over here. Like I said, my love of my life is from Lewisburg, and the guitar player that we have with us in Crash Test Dummies is none other than Stuart Cameron, which is the son of the great John Allen Cameron. I've got little tentacles that are reaching out into Cape Breton all the time.
Yeah, that's some major connections there. Okay, major connections. I think everybody knows of the Crash Test Dummies. Okay, and their success and pretty well worldwide known. We even know about them here in Cape Breton. you're the drummer, but you're. In your bio, it describes you as a multi-instrumentalist. What else do you play?
Well, I can get by. I'm playing, some keyboards. I can get by. I'm playing some guitar, maybe some bass guitar. But those are never things that I would play out in public.
Yeah, you're a drummer.
I have a studio at home, and I spend a lot of time composing music for film and television and stuff like that. And in the privacy of my own in studio, I can pick up any instrument and work my way through it and make a lot of mistakes, but I can just go back and record it again. But I would never venture to get out on stage and be the multi-instrumentalist. I'm comfortable being the drummer, I'm comfortable being in the back, and life is grand.
All right, tell us why, the exact reason you've been visiting high schools throughout the area and continue to do so for the next week or so. What's it all about?
Well, I have a particular way of seeing things in the world, and I think a way of connecting with our youth of today, and I don't even like using those kinds of terms. I have a perspective on trying to maybe get through with some of the problems that we're having on the planet. I don't necessarily have any solid solutions. But I think I do have a way of being able to instigate, get some people thinking about how we can solve some of them. And a lot of it just being, without being specific, I think just trying to think responsibly about what we're doing, looking at maybe some of the issues that we're maybe construing as being wrong thinking. But I just say we just need to change the thinking. It's not about blaming or being right or wrong. I just think we need to change the thinking on how we're looking at some of these things.
So when you're talking to a high school students, you're how do you get that message across? Because you're talking to kids at an age that they're making a lot of big decisions.
Sure. First of all, I refuse to use the word kids. To me, kids are the little ones that are at home, like before they get to school.
Should you say young people, young adults?
They're people.
Yeah.
They're students. When we're in school, we're students.
Good point.
I think it's probably the best way to highlight how it is that I think. When I'm walking into a school, as far as I'm concerned, I'm sharing space with a lot of people that are just younger than I am. That's all. But they've all got great ideas. They're all good thinkers. They're all smart people. But I've been on the planet a little longer, so maybe I've seen some things that they haven't. But they really know a lot of things. They're really smart people. They know a lot more than we give them credit for.
And do you get your message across? Do they listen?
I think 99% of the time I present myself in such a way that says, look, here's a clean slate. I've got some ideas, and first of all, I'm going to show you that I'm probably a little crazier than you are, and I'm going to put my soul out there. I'm going to be an open book, and after we've established that maybe I'm kind of worth listening to, give me a shot, and I would probably say 99% of the time that at least I get a shot. Am I being listened to? Yeah, I would say that I am, but I'm probably, maybe they're lending me an ear. Maybe that's a better way to look at it.
Give me an example then. Give me an example of what you would tell them, and what, you know, of a choice that they have to make, and how would you deal with it?
That's so multifaceted. You know, I would probably think to say something to the effect of, I'm not going to be Mr. Anti-Drug. I'm not going to stand up there and tell you what you should do with your life. However, here's some ideas, and here's the way that I look at it, on how we might look at the whole drug problem. And rather than say that it's right or wrong or good or bad, what can we do to educate ourselves so that if and when that drug should ever cross our path, that we can make an educated choice? So I think for a long time, people have been coming along and saying, if you do this and do that, you're going to get in trouble, you're going to die, you're going to end up in jail, you're going to end up being an addict, all that kind of stuff. I don't think we need to go that far. I think that people are smart enough that if you say, look, here's some information, and look at it for yourself. You don't need me. We have the internet these days.
Yeah.
And if you want to learn something, you can just type it into the internet and get lots of information about what it is that you're trying to learn.
Powerful tool, so if it's used the right way, right?
Exactly. And they don't really need me for that. I don't need to go in there and tell them what they already know. However, what I can do is try to create a ground where we're both talking about the same information. So, here's what I know, here's what you know. Let's compare notes, and let's take it from there. The worst thing I think I could ever do is to try to show up in a school and, to try to be some sort of authority on any particular subject. But I think I can open the gates and say, what information can we share? Here's how I think. What do you think?
I know you've been talking to students and will continue to do so, but you also have a session coming up next week for parents.
Oh, really looking forward to that one. I think that if I can take my particular slant on how I view things and how I see things coming up, and then how I can see that we can make some changes just in how we deal with the circumstances that we've created. I'm not going to stand up there and say, kids today. I would never do that. But what I can do is I can say, here's our situation. Here's how I think we got to where we are. And here's some small ideas of how we can instigate some change to get a better palette going for the future.
Now, that session's coming up, I should tell everybody, April 16th at the Grand Lake Road Fire Hall at 7 o'clock. You want to pack that place.
Oh, I'd love it to be full. It takes, there's an old adage that says it takes a community to raise a child. Mm-hmm. And I still kind of believe that. And I think that, to get people out and to try to find new ideas to make the world a better place, I think when we see that, that gives me grand faith in communities and gives me lots of hope for the future.
It's called Common Group Solutions, and the plan is to use money from the province to pay cab fares for people who can't afford transportation to work or school. The group has held a number of events in the regional municipality to talk about the pilot program, and Dialogue spoke to the group's social enterprise development manager for Cape Breton, Rebecca Dunphy.
We offer support to individuals starting social enterprises or already existing social enterprises, or anybody looking to get more involved in the social sector. So we do a variety of things. We have training services as well as coaching, and we do a fair amount of consulting. And so this is the Community Connects is one of those consulting projects.
Okay, so you deal a lot with nonprofits, cooperatives, that sort of thing?
Yeah, and for-profits that are focused on a social mission, anybody that's working to meet a social, environmental, economic, or cultural mandate.
Okay. So I want to get into the transportation pilot project eventually, but tell us a bit about some of the other projects you've worked on.
So we worked on a variety of projects. I won't give too many specific details in case if somebody isn't comfortable being, discussed on the radio, but right now
sure.
We're actually involved with three of the innovation labs that the province started. So they have one down in the Tri-Counties working to address the child care shortages, as well as there is another one going around on in the north end of Halifax, working with youth in the area and getting them engaged in their community and getting all set for a bright future. And then we are also taking on the Transportation Innovation Lab up in CBRM. So those are three of the big projects that we have on the go right now. We also do a variety of trainings. We do a Steps to Startup training where we have individuals that are just working with a business idea or have a business that they're looking to, you know, rejig something in. They can come and do the Steps to Startup program with us, as well as we do a lot of work with organizations around impact measurements, so looking at their social return on investment and the impact that they have on their community.
And these services, do they cost anything or...?
Yeah, so we are a social enterprise ourselves, and there is a fee for our services, and that varies, and sometimes there are, you know, programs that help us to subsidize the cost, but since we are a social enterprise ourselves, we do have a fee.
And you are getting subsidies from the province for the transportation pilot project.
Yes. The transportation project is funded by the province, yeah.
Oh, it's fully funded. Okay. So tell us a bit about the project. I understand you're offering cab rides to people who might have difficulty making it to a job or a school. What made the organization want to start that program?
Yeah, so we started this in March of 2018, and we were working closely with a group that actually started in 2014 that were looking to analyze the community transportation situation in CBRM. So this working group came together and they identified a number of gaps and key areas that they wanted to focus on in order to enhance the transportation services in CBRM. And a big thing that they heard during these initial conversations were from employers identifying that they were having some trouble filling vacancies due to limitations around transportation. And also there was a lot of stories of individuals having issues maintaining a job or staying in school because of the transportation issues in the area. So that was a lot of, you know, research that had been done prior to the lab getting started. So when we started in 2018, it was really talking with this working group that was already developed a couple years earlier. And Common Good was advised by a local advisory committee and overseen by the Department of Community Services. And our primary focus was on connecting underemployed and underemployed individuals in CBRM with employment opportunities across the island. So by identifying a potential transportation solution, we did this by, you know, forming that working group lab team of, you know, individuals that are experiencing this firsthand and that have had trouble staying in jobs or finding jobs due to transportation barriers, as well as employers that were looking to fill labor shortages and community organizations and other advocates in the area. So we concluded the first phase of the project in September of 2018. And what came from that is that we felt that a point-to-point shuttle service was the best solution to the issues that we discussed over that first phase. And then in December, we got approved for the second round of the project. And this was really about, you know, further designing and testing the point-to-point prototype. So that's where we're at now. So we've developed Community Connects, which is a point-to-point shuttle service for individuals looking to get to education programs and to work. So this will run from April 23rd is when we launch, and will run until mid-October, since it is just a pilot period that we have funding for. And we're just really looking at implementing and adapting this to test its overall effectiveness at increasing, you know, access for workers and aspiring workers who earn a low income to get to work, as well as individuals looking to access educational opportunities.
Okay, so if this pilot project is successful, then will it go province-wide? Is that the aim, or...?
We're going to see what comes after we finish the second phase. Once we're done, all the prototyping learnings will be shared with the province, including any recommendations for further support or expanding the model.
Okay, so who are some of these people that are having trouble? I mean, obviously without betraying any confidences or anything, just give us a sense of who some of these people are that you're talking to and the challenges that they're facing.
Well, we've been talking with a lot of folks that are in every community. So we talk with people, we've done, you know, information sessions and community engagement sessions in Sydney, North Sydney, Sydney Mines, New Waterford, Glace Bay, and everywhere in CBRM, just trying to figure out, you know, what are these gaps? We've been talking with individuals that are on a lower income and have had a hard time finding employment that can work within their schedules and the hours that they're available to work, especially when the positions that they're getting may have, you know, night shift here and there and that kind of stuff that doesn't accommodate the bus schedules, and they aren't able to afford a taxi there and back because, you know, it can be $40 one way if you're going from X to Y. And we've also been talking with a lot of people that were either going to school and while they were enrolled, they weren't able to, you know, make classes. They were either an hour early or 20 minutes late, and it was just becoming such a headache to juggle transportation. And so they would end up, you know, dropping out or staying for work if it got to a point that it was, you know, they were offered a job in let's say, Sydney, but they were living in a rural area of New Waterford. They couldn't accept it because they just didn't have reliable transportation to get to and from.
So what have the results been so far?
So we haven't actually launched yet. We launch on the 23rd, but in terms of people engaging with the project and reaching out to get more information, it's been constant since we put it out. People are really, you know, hopeful and encouraged by this. I got one email today that was just somebody saying that, you know, now I'm able to expand my job market. I'm able to go into Glace Bay or Sydney and look for other jobs. Although this is opening a lot of doors for people. If anybody's interested in learning more about the service, they can check out the Facebook page at Community Connects, or they can go onto the website at mycommunityconnects.ca. Right now, we are getting everything sorted for the coordinator position that will be in charge of organizing all the rides, and so folks can reach out to them once that number is up and running. And then the service will be launching April 23rd, and it's exciting.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue three times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.